We turn our attention now to Burma, or Myanmar, if you prefer. Although Nobel laureate and longtime political opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house arrest by the military junta last year, and a round of elections were held recently, that doesn't mean democracy is just around the corner. Joining me now is Joshua Hammer, whose article on Aung San Suu Kyi and the political situation in Burma, titled A Free Woman, is in the January 24th issue of The New Yorker, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks.
Didn't you first travel to Burma 3 decades ago? Can you give us a sense of...
I'm embarrassed to admit my age.
Well, you were just a child.
Just a child. A child, a post-college backpacking tour of Asia. Just in those days, you were allowed a one-week visa to visit the country in a very carefully prescribed route. There were about 4 or 5 places on the map that you could visit. As I write in the story, you know, everybody was instructed to bring in a fifth of Johnny Walker and a couple of cartons of Marlboro cigarettes, and you know, trade them on the black market, and basically made enough cash, local currency, to keep you going for a week if you were doing the low-budget backpacking thing. So that's exactly what I did. The country was just so totally starved for Western goods of any kind. It was really a time warp.
And the junta was already in power?
Actually, at that time, the junta had been in power for almost 20 years. It was in the midst of the Ne Win era, which was a socialist, isolated socialist regime that pretty much cut the country off from any interaction with the West, as well as the East. I mean, it was really I think his idea was to sort of create a almost North Korea-like state. And it was just it was a pauper state. I mean, it was a truly bizarre experience being there at that time.
You interviewed Aung San Suu Kyi for your article in The New Yorker. Does that mean that the junta is now allowing her to speak to foreigners?
Well, it's a curious situation. Technically, she's free. She can meet with whoever she wants. The regime does not allow Western journalists to visit the country. Or very rarely will issue visas. So basically what you do is you go in as a tourist, and then the regime plants its agents outside the office of Aung San Suu Kyi and checks out everybody who, by observation, photographs, whatever, everybody who's going in or out, follows them. Occasionally, journalists have been stopped and arrested and deported. So because they're there under false circumstances.
Which was your case?
Sorry, excuse me?
Which was the case with you?
Yeah, I went in as a tourist, yes. And what I had scoped out the route ahead of time. I don't want to make this sound like too much of a James Bond operation, but I'd scoped out the route ahead of time and had sort of figured out a path I would take where taxis would leave me in front of one hotel. I'd go in and out the back exit and get another taxi to another hotel, Western hotel, and pull the same stunt a couple of times. And if there was anybody following me, presumably by the third hotel and the long run through the market, I would have eluded them. I didn't get the sense, actually, that anybody was following me, although I did that routine just in case. But definitely others have been followed, and a couple of colleagues of mine have been deported after visiting Aung San Suu Kyi.
Well, she's been held in isolation by the regime for 15 of the last 21 years. What's her health like? She's 65 years old now, isn't she?
Well, she seems pretty frail, but her physician has been with her for 2 decades and watches her very carefully. He says that her weight has maintained, she has maintained the same weight for 20 years. Her blood pressure is okay. He is giving her occasional injections of vitamins to keep her going because I think the transition from that very tranquil, isolated world under house arrest and the shock of coming outside and being besieged by everybody has just, as she admits, created a great physical strain on her.
The next round of elections is scheduled 5 years from now. Do you expect that she'd be able to assume a leadership position in the country when she's 70 years old and in frail health, as you say?
I don't want to exaggerate her health conditions. I mean, her health. She seemed, I would say, gaunt, but she's a very delicate woman, delicately built, very fine bones. So she gives off an appearance of fragility, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she's, you know, physically ill. I mean, her doctor did not mention any sort of serious physical ailments, except for some back pain, you know, upper limb pain. I don't see why she couldn't be the leader. In fact, there really is nobody else. Plenty of people like Mandela emerged from prison at an age, 75, I believe, or certainly was a septuagenarian, and had a very vigorous political career afterwards. So I don't think anybody is disqualifying Aung San Suu Kyi from being a political player 5 years from now.
Joshua Hammer is my guest on today's Backstory. His article, A Free Woman, is in the January 24th issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Aung San Suu Kyi told you that she's still eager to build the democracy movement in, we're calling it Burma, right? But you write that the opposition in Burma is arguably weaker than ever.
Well, it's fragmented. She's been away from it, sort of running it basically through her only contact with her opposition movement was her lawyer for most of the last 15 years. Occasional orders instructions would be issued from the villa to her lawyer, who would then presumably pass them down to the Central Committee. There's a lot of, as WikiLeaks recently reported, when it revealed U.S. State Department concerns about the fact that the average age of, this is a real gerontocracy, this opposition movement. I mean, if you go into her headquarters, you see that the people surrounding her are all in their 70s, some of them are in their 80s. There's not a really developed youth movement, nobody really to carry on the torch. In addition to that, the opposition was split by this election in 2010. Aung San Suu Kyi wanted to boycott it, demanded a boycott. Others said, no way, this is our one shot. We know the whole thing is rigged. We know the military, we know it's essentially a charade, but we have to participate. We have to get some sort of political space and, you know, take it from there. Maybe 5 years from now, we'll be able to build on this. So that divided the opposition. A lot of her closest associates, people who had been with her from the beginning of the creation of this party, split, took off and founded a rival party. There's very bad blood between these two groups. It never bodes well for an opposition when it splits like this. So she definitely has a lot of work to do.
They're the NDF.
NDF, National Democratic Front.
Judging from what had happened in a previous election, would it have mattered if she had run and won?
Well, she would not have won. I mean, the regime had the deck stacked. There was no way they were going to allow her. There was no way they were going to allow a repeat of 1990 and let the results spiral out of their control. But she might have. Certainly, the opposition would have gained many more seats in this parliamentary creation of the military. But I'm not sure it would have made any difference. I mean, the government, the regime has the deck pretty well stacked.
The United States began sanctions against the military junta in the 90s. The European Union followed suit in 2006, not all that long ago. Have the sanctions had any punitive effect on the regime? I wonder, because the breakaway opposition group that we talked about, the NDF, has recently called for sanctions from the West to be lifted. And you write that Aung San Suu Kyi rolled her eyes when you asked her about that.
Yeah, but it's a question she keeps hearing, and now she's got her own people inside, you know, her former party loyalists now coming out against sanctions. So she's under a lot of pressure to reconsider this whole policy. A lot of people argue that it just hasn't worked, that the regime has just turned to China, that it's not suffering at all, that the only people that have really been suffering from sanctions are the middle class, and the middle class are exactly the people that you want to be empowered to create a democracy. And, of course, there's also the argument that by imposing these sanctions, you've really cut the country off from any sort of Western influence. And that had sanctions not been in place during these years, you would have seen a very different Burma, and one that might have, of its own accord, just moved closer towards a Western style democracy. The whole thing is debatable. It's purely hypothetical. There are arguments to be made in favor of sanctions, against sanctions. A lot of people point to South Africa situation. Sanctions work there. Why not in Burma? But the interesting thing is that Aung San Suu Kyi appears to be backing off a little bit from the sanctions argument. Earlier on, she was just adamant that this was the only possible policy, but now she's not saying that anymore.
Well, the Burmese historian Thant Mien U told you that the opposition and Aung San Suu Kyi made a number of mistakes in dealing with the regime early on, including their belief that help from the West through a mix of sanctions and diplomacy would somehow force the regime to bargain. Obviously, that hasn't happened. And one of the reasons is that Burma is rich in natural resources, and even countries like Thailand, which should be going along with the West, well, it would just be they'd be losing too much if they.
Burma has a really close relationship now with a lot of its Asian neighbors, with India, with Korea, especially with China. They don't impose sanctions. They're happy to do business with the Burmese government. Burmese government has a lot of things to sell.
India again, also.
India as well, and basically all of its neighbors. So that strengthens the argument that these Western sanctions have been ineffectual, and certainly, it hasn't really led to any political opening whatsoever. If anything, the regime has been more hardline. Is now, one could argue, stronger than ever. It's got, it's building, pouring billions of dollars into this capital in the jungle that it built, this kind of showcase for itself, and spending money that is rolling in from Asia, from China. They don't really seem to care that the West is punishing them and, denying them visas and denying their children access to fine American and British prep schools. It doesn't really seem to faze them.
Didn't the WikiLeaks diplomatic cables reveal that the junta may be working on a nuclear program with the help of the North Koreans?
Yeah, there's talk about that, but I talked to a couple of Western diplomats, and they were really, really careful and hedging on that, on whether there was any evidence of that. A lot of circumstantial evidence, but it's possible. The regime has a lot of money, and it's got a lot of ambition, and it's feeling very powerful now. So it's not inconceivable.
Well, they've been involved in bloody conflicts with a number of ethnic minorities in various parts of the country. Isn't that a drain on the economy?
Yeah, but another sign of the regime's strength is the fact that there's some ongoing ethnic wars, but many of these rebellions have been quelled over the last few years. There have been ceasefires signed left and right. There's still an old communist insurgency here and a Shan state rebellion there, but it's certainly nothing like it was in the 90s and earlier last decade. So,
well, what about
another sign that the regime is strong?
The Saffron Revolution looked like it might actually have some effect. That 2007. Now I hear there is an estimated 2,100 political prisoners in Burmese jails, many of them monks who were involved in the Saffron Revolution.
Yeah, some of them are still in jail 3-4 years later. There were tough censorship laws. Aung San Suu Kyi talked about a little bit of an opening, but I interviewed a lot of artists and writers there, and I didn't get the sense that there was much of an opening. The only thing I did notice was that there's a newspaper called the Myanmar Times, which is an English language paper, normally heavily, heavily, heavily censored, and they actually had on page 3 of the issue I picked up of a photo of Aung San Suu Kyi greeting her son Kim at the airport. So that was probably the first time in a decade that there had actually been a picture of Aung San Suu Kyi in a government-controlled, government-censored newspaper. So you could call that a thaw. On the other hand, a couple of other papers printed that same picture on the front page, and they were immediately shut down. So So, because apparently they violated the agreement that they were allowed to publish a picture of Aung San Suu Kyi, but only buried in the middle of the paper.
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi is from an important family in Burmese history, but isn't her brother a U.S. citizen who has kind of close ties to the ruling junta?
Yeah, her brother has been a nuisance for her for more than a decade. He's been filing a couple of lawsuits trying to get his hands on the villa in which she was held, for the family-owned villa in which she was held for most of the last 15 years. So far, the courts have actually ruled against him, which a lot of people have been surprised by. But he is it's kind of an interesting sibling story. The siblings really, really despise each other.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton telephoned Aung San Suu Kyi yesterday, marking the first cabinet-level conversation with the opposition leader in 15 years. Is that just a symbolic kind of conversation at a time when we're chiding the Chinese for their human rights violations?
Yeah, it might be. It might be timed specifically for that purpose. I mean, it is interesting that you had the state visit Chinese premier at the same time that call was going on. I don't know if it's coincidental or not, but possibly. I don't know, and I don't know what was said in that conversation. But I would not be surprised if, you know, there might have been some mention of China. Who knows?
You did say that you noticed cell phones and satellite dishes in Burma. So they're not completely cut off.
Just tremendously in 30 years. It's a different – I was kind of disappointed because the Rangoon that I'd remembered was, I said, this time warp city of 1930s and 1940s automobiles, and it had this kind of just corroded, decrepit charm. Now it looks kind of at the first glance like a slightly run down but very much globalized Asian city. Internet cafes, modern cars, pizzerias and sushi bars. So things have changed there tremendously, and satellite dishes on virtually every apartment building.
Joshua Hammer's article, A Free Woman, is in the January 24th issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for talking with us on our first Backstory segment today.
Thank you, Leonard.